Welcome to Alert and Oriented's new mini-series, The Doctor's Playbook, where we dive into the minds of medical experts to explore clinical reasoning, diagnostic strategies, and the art of patient care. In each episode, we'll unpack the frameworks, insights, and lessons that have shaped their journeys as clinicians. Our goal is to help you refine your approach by merging their expertise with your own unique style, empowering you to navigate complex cases and deliver exceptional care. Along the way, we'll also explore their personal stories, career paths, and the values that drive their practice. Whether you're a medical student, resident, or a seasoned physician, there's something here for everyone. My name is Andrew Mohama, and I'm excited to be your host for today's episode.
This excellent medical student-led podcast is for educational purposes only and not intended to be used as medical advice under any circumstance.
I'm thrilled to be joined by Dr. Naeem Batif, a rising chief internal medicine resident at the Stroger County Hospital of Cook County in Chicago, Illinois. He has one of the most inspiring journeys in medicine that I've come across. Naeem's story is one of perseverance, adaptability, and an unwavering passion for medicine. Born and raised in a small town in Homs, Syria, his fascination with the heart began early, sparked by a childhood visit to a cardiologist, a family friend who could seemingly read a patient's heart through lines on something called an EKG. The way the up and down lines translated into a diagnosis felt like unlocking a secret code to Naeem. And in that moment, as a young kid, he knew he wanted to become a physician someday. Medical school in Syria laid the foundation for his journey, but his dreams stretched far beyond. He aspired to train in the United States, drawn by its medical innovation and research opportunities. However, the road to achieving that dream was anything but straightforward. Despite his dedication and very strong board exam scores, multiple visa rejections kept him from entering the US system. But rather than seeing these as dead ends, he viewed them as detours. He pivoted and started training at Hamad Medical Corporation in Qatar, a highly regarded program affiliated with Weill Cornell. At the same time, he built backup plans, earning his MRCP certification in the UK and even qualifying for the Australian Medical Board. And finally, after many years of persistence, he matched into internal medicine residency at Stroger Cook County in Chicago. Today, he's in his third year of this internal medicine residency, and he will soon begin his fourth year serving as the chief resident and preparing for the next phase, a cardiology fellowship. Naeem's story is not just about persistence, it's about the impact of teaching and mentorship. During medical school, he discovered a deep love for teaching, realizing that explaining concepts to junior students sharpened his own understanding. That passion has only grown, leading him to pursue a master's in clinical investigation at Northwestern and inspiring future goals of earning a master's in medical education alongside his cardiology fellowship. For Naeem, it's clear that medicine is not just about mastering the science, it's about giving back, lifting others, and continuously learning. His journey from a small town in Syria to the heart of American medicine is proof that setbacks don't define you, your persistence does. Naeem, welcome to the Doctor's Playbook.
Thank you, Andrew, for having me today. Thank you so much for this introduction. Thank you so much.
Of course. It's surreal to be sitting here with you. I first met you maybe in November time, early December, when I did my internal medicine rotation at Cook County. I remember walking into the workroom and I saw a man wearing a white coat. He had nice colored pens. He had a fancy tie. And I thought, wow, this must be the most respected attending at Cook County. And I learned shortly after that you were a resident. But you carried yourself with such professionalism, and the way you spoke made me think you've been practicing for so many years. And in some ways, it is true. You've had a very long training just to get to where you are today. And I just want for people listening to get an understanding of just how much effort Naeem has put into his training to be where he is today. So Naeem, please correct me if I'm wrong.
Sure.
So in 2014, you graduated medical school in Syria, and you started your internal medicine residency there in Syria.
Correct.
You spent 3 years doing internal med residency, and then you even did a full year of pulmonary and critical care fellowship in Syria.
Correct.
After that, you went to Qatar, and you spent another 4 years.
Internal medicine residency.
Another 4 years internal medicine. So at this point, you've now done training for 8 years in Qatar. And then you matched to Cook County for another internal medicine training.
Another 3 years, and chief year, I would say four, and now BGY 12.
Yeah. So Naeem has some of the most internal medicine training there is of maybe any resident out there. So his knowledge is clearly very strong. And my question for you, Naeem, is in this journey, what instilled such perseverance and such dedication to continue despite all these years?
Honestly, the answer will go to my early childhood. As you said, I was born and raised in a middle-class family, but I have two high-achiever sisters. Back home, they were top on one of the top on their school, and then they set that bar very high to me. I always was identified as Najaf's brother. I will be the first in class. And that, to be honest, put in myself a lot of responsibility. And then to get medicine in CDS, it's not straightforward. The top of top students, you need to be like scoring very high in the high school to get the medicine. And that will build up a spirit of competition in your side. And once I get into the medical school, I was the first doctor, by the way, first doctor in my whole extended entire family. Everyone in the family believe in you, and that's the doctor. I was in second year or third year in medical school, and then they were consulting me for big questions, like of heart failure. I mean, I feel like this is another level of responsibility. This is, to be honest, was fueling me on all the entire journey and just pushing me to pursue the best. There's people believing in you. That's, I don't think there's something powerful than this feeling.
Yeah. Wow. It's a lesson for, I think, people in the U.S. like myself who pursued medical school. It's easy to sometimes complain about some of the barriers in the way, but it's clear that if you have a reason for continuing it, even in those setbacks, that it won't stop you, is how I'm interpreting your journey.
Yeah.
So I want to dive in on that a little bit more. You've talked about these setbacks being detours rather than dead ends. Was there any moment so far in your training and your journey where you almost lost hope, where you almost thought, I don't think I can continue to aspire to the dream of going to the U.S. and training?
I remember a couple moments, I think. Yeah, but one of them was the frustrating moment, as you said, in my journey, when I was planning I applied to the United States multiple times and my visa get rejected. So I just have it plan B and plan C and plan D and maybe plan E. At that time, I applied to Qatar, to the Hamad Medical Corporation. As you said, it's in a wide corneal affiliated hospital. I put all the energy and put everything and pushed forward just to get the spot there. And it was accepted. But unfortunately, again, the visa was an obstacle. So I felt at that moment, I felt like all the doors are closed. In a dark spot, and I'm not sure what I should do. Everything seems like it's not working. But to be honest, it might or might not give you a bad or negative feeling. But I remember that time, I just changed my mindset. And I said, okay, I was rejected today. Maybe I'll get that accepted tomorrow. And I put all my efforts toward just learning a new skills, which is as the pulmonary fellowship. I did 1 year in pulmonary critical care. At that time, all the entire energy that I have, okay, let's do it. Apply some fellowship here and see, and then we'll see the future what we do. Since you are doing what you think is the right things, and then continue. And then I applied the next year. And then thankfully, I got matched there.
Wow.
Amazing difference.
So Naeem, through these different countries, these different programs, something on this podcast we try to ask guests about is clinical reasoning strategies, frameworks, different diagnostic approaches. And you're the first guest who's trained in multiple different countries. So from this experience, have you noticed any differences when it comes to clinical reasoning based on your training?
I would say yes. Clinical reasoning basically based on statistics and then biostatistics, how much that the prevalence, incidence of diseases, and also the epidemiology and etiology of most of the diseases. I'll give you an example. Like when I remember the first day here in Cook County as a resident, internal medicine resident, I have a patient with 50-year-old something with cough, like subacute cough to chronic cough, and then having some hemoptysis, like coughing blood out, and then with some weight loss, and then the differential diagnosis that came to everyone's mind is lung cancer, or maybe fungal infection, but more than lung cancer until proven otherwise. If you go to the other part of the ward, they will put the tuberculosis in the first top differential. When I mentioned tuberculosis, that everyone like, was looking at me, oh my goodness, what are you saying? This disease, maybe we'll see case or two cases in the whole entire year. But that will absolutely change the whole entire way of thinking. I'm not saying this lung cancer more incident or where you are in a country, have a more prevalent and more incidence of these diseases, you need to consider it as a top of your differential. And then again, there's small details like IBD is more common in the Middle East. Like we have a lot of IBD cases, inflammatory bowel disease. Patient with unknown fever of unknown origin, they come to the hospital. Most of the cases, like if you heard about it, like fever, Mediterranean fever is one of top differential. I never heard a case of fever in the States. Again, also histoplasmosis, blastomycosis, and this stuff. When I came to the States, the most important question we're asking about the patient is coming from where? Is it from the East Coast or from the West Coast? It's all about what kind of maybe disease can I put on my differential. That will affect your clinical reasoning just to know what is the most common etiology in this spot of the world. So I think that's what changed dramatically my way of thinking.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So you find yourself constantly when you're seeing a patient, you go down to the ED, they ask you to come see them. You're thinking already in your head, what could be the most common, most prevalent based on all these different factors?
Yeah.
Is that something you're thinking about every day?
Absolutely. I always teach my students and my junior residents about there's any single medical professional should have at least 4 or 5 differential diagnoses in their mind as an intuitive way of thinking. Once I mention the symptom, when I tell you, like, Andrew, you have a patient with shortness of breath, absolutely, you have to have at least 5 differential in your mind before even tell you the second or the next information about this patient. But in shortness of breath, how old the patient? Before you can how old the patient, shortness of breath, you need to think about what the etiology is. Now, this is a way, as I said, is intuitive way of thinking, and you need to put it in statistics. And then just, again, to put everything in a correct way. Yeah, but again, as I said, when you are in different part of that board, you need to consider different differentials.
That makes sense. So I guess I'm curious, through this training, how did you begin building your clinical reasoning skills? What has stood out to you to be maybe the most important component or process when it comes to formulating clinical impression?
All right. So for that, it's obvious. Well, I would say reading. But there is one hand. I'm not sure if Harrison of internal medicine is still a thing. You were, let's say, in these days. But I remember myself, dedicated quite an interesting time, about just reading the first 300 or 400 pages of Harrison about just differential diagnosis and how to approach diseases based on the symptoms. It's very valuable. I would recommend just to go through it if you are interested in internal medicine. They have a very interesting approach. I know nowadays with AI, with a lot of other tools and stuff, but still I feel like it's old but gold. This knee approach, chest pain approach, I learned a lot of this. Plus, I had a huge plus for the exposure. When you have a good volume, you have a good exposure, you can test your theory. When you are building up your approach, you are not going to be born with a full set approach. You need to build it yourself day by day. When you have a good knowledge, platform of knowledge, this is the most important thing, and you start testing your theory or testing your approach, you need a good volume, good exposure. That's what happened to me. I never had only one patient or 2 patients a day, even 7 patients or 10 patients, and if you have 1 or 2, I go and see the other resident patient. I need to see what's going on. I had the curiosity about knowing what's going on with the other patients. And I think these two things, good background, fund of knowledge, and then also exposure, would make you a good clinical reasoner.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think something I think a lot about is picking the right mentor, the right teacher, or I guess being willing to learn from the right mentor and right teacher. For example, when I was rotating at Cook County and you were on the team, I learned so much from you. I thought, this is someone who I admire their clinical reasoning approach. I admire that they're always asking why. They're asking about what's the etiology? How can this help explain what's happening and how we can treat them? I'm at the early stage in my career. I'm still a medical student. But for you, through these years in your journey, did you have a mentor or someone you looked up to that you wanted to emulate their experiences, the way they approached medicine? And I'm curious how that might have influenced your approach.
Yeah, and every country I was there, I have a mentor. Just, you need to get back to someone to ask their opinion and also to reset your direction. So you need to know if you're in the right track or you're just a different way. So in Syria and Qatar, I have great mentors. But what now is cracking my mind, Dr. Benjamin Emba, one of the landmark figure that big figure he was in Cook County. I was fortunate to work with him 1 year before I think he went to Yale now. I feel like I learned the real meaning of clinical reasoning when we had a mid. Cook County is very famous about the noon report on Friday. I think you've been to one of them. So the way who just ask for residents and to get to the bottom of things and how you put the information, the statistics and the pretest probabilities and then how to understand that this process and based on the Bayesian approach, I think one of the unforgettable mentors that I would say. I learned a lot from him, and also he helped me a lot just to redirect my as I said, my whole entire journey to know what I want, to be honest.
You speak different languages, of course. You mentioned to me earlier today that when you trained in Syria and you learned the medical school there, the teaching was in Arabic. And then when you left Syria, the teaching was in English.
Correct.
So Tell me about this experience of learning medicine in different languages. And I guess I'm curious, how did that influence your ability to pick up on different parts of medicine as you've progressed throughout your career so far?
Yeah. It's interesting. There's 23 Arab countries, and Syria is the only one that teaches medicine in Arabic. And not only the medicine material, also the medical term in Arabic. So as there's some countries, like maybe they have the whole entire material in their language, but the terms is in Latin or in English or whatever. In Syria, we have also the medical terms. It helped me, of course, it helped me with dealing with people in different cultures, different languages. I understand what they are referring to. I remember an interesting case. I was in Qatar. There's a guy, he was diagnosed with hydronephrosis in one of the countries. And he remembered the word in Arabic, it's called istisqa. And then the attending was seeing him, it was Arabic in original, but he's not Syrian and he doesn't know what the meaning of istisqa. So he quoted as maybe an ascites, because istisqa coming from water and then maybe an ascites. And then they start having a very detailed history from him. And then once they mention istisqa, for me, it's a hydronephrosis. He's talking about his kidneys. The point is, the patients, when they know some medical, especially in their own language, they understand their disease. That's my take home for this. They understand their disease very well. Because if you mention it for someone who's not speaking English, either for people, they speak English, and they told them, this is a pneumothorax. What do you think or expect they will know? You need to just break it down and tell them there's some air around it, around their lung. But if you told someone, even if in the general population, see, you have a thorax, but then in Arabic, they would understand what the meaning of free. That's build a good trust with your patient, and at the same time, you glean a lot of information from your patient. It helped a lot, especially with dealing with different background. Down here in Chicago, I feel like I'm intrigued to learn Spanish. We have a significant number of volume of patients with Spanish speaking, and that's what I started. I think now is the level of Spanish. Yeah. And the languages are very interesting. Yeah.
That's fascinating. I can't imagine reaching the point of you finish your residency in Syria, you've almost mastered it, and then you have to move to a country and it's in a different language. And in some ways, I imagine it felt like you were starting over.
Yeah. It is starting over. And in some way, it was frustrating, just learning every single thing again in a different language. I would say if you are younger, you're teenagers, and you start learning a new language, it would be easy. But it's not only learning new language, learning medicine in a new language. Like a bunch of my friends, like they learned German language with the Dutch. I think they went to Germany, but for me, it wasn't a choice. I found it very difficult. I stick with the English thing. It's frustrating, but you will not realize until it's done. But it's a challenge, but it will open your mind for a lot of different choices.
Yeah.
Especially.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think your point is so right, that when a patient is able to talk about their medical condition in their own language, in their own culture, their way of understanding it, if the doctor can also speak that same language, there's a different level of connection and understanding. And it's more than just the medicine at that point. It becomes a level of trust.
Building a relationship. Yeah. I mean, building the rapport with your patient. They trust you. They know that you understand. Especially when you can't talk with them something something not medical. And then just, to build up the relationship first. And then you go and ask. And then you will be surprised that you will glean more information from these patients.
Mm. Yeah. I remember a memory I had when I was working with you. We were in the workroom at County, and I went to go see a patient. They had an ulcer on their foot.
Yeah.
And I started to think, Naeem would want me to think of the etiology. So I started to think, okay, this could be arterial, could be venous, could be pressure, all these different things. And I'm thinking out loud, I asked you your thoughts on it. And immediately you turned to your bag, you grabbed your iPad out, and within maybe 10 seconds, you had flipped to some page of notes you had taken at some point, which beautifully outlined all the different etiologies of ulcers, how to tell the difference and where you should think through them when you see a patient with one. I was pretty struck by this. I thought, not only did he know all of this on the top of his head, he had somewhere he had written it down. How do you do this? What is your best approach to remember things, to stay organized through such a massive amount of content?
Yeah, I'll be honest with you. My trick is a case-based studying. The only difference between me and you, maybe I saw many cases or more cases than I took. That's the only difference. So what I used to do when I have a new case in medicine, I go and dig deep to the bottom of things. And then always I summarize everything. And I have files on my iPad before I have a small handbook just to write down what I want for my top differential. But I have files, and then based on these files, based on the cases, let's say lower limb ulcers, based on the clinical reasoning I start with, and then what the top differential and what the Yes, one line treatment. And then whenever, you know, we're human being at the end of the day, you will forget every time. Maybe you will encounter this case today and then never encounter it until 6 months in the future. So always I have, this is my shortcut, my tweet. I mean, open the file immediately. I know there is a lot of approachable tools like UpToDate or whatever, but I want to see the same information that I summarized about this topic back in the day, so I would remember it very quick. That's my trick in general. And to be honest, you'll be surprised also, you're not gonna find many cases in medicine or the daily medicine, I'm saying. You'll see like a certain number of cases. It's the beating itself every day, like heart failure patients, COPD patients, lower limb ulcers, like the diabetic foot infection, pneumonia. These are the bread and butter of medicine. So once you have your own shortcut or your own tweak in your mind, that will serve you amazingly in your life and especially in career.
Mm. So what would your advice be to people like me who early on now, we have at our disposal so many tools. We have AI, for example. You can plug in your question and immediately you can shoot out all these options. What do you see as the harm of this and maybe as the benefit? And how would you best advise people to use this as to not maybe shortcut clinical reasoning, but to assist them? Do you have any approach so far to AI, how you tell people about?
I would say it's like a sword with many what we call the two faces.
Uh-huh.
So it will help the experts in the field more than the people that are seeking their career, their medical students or junior doctors. You need to build your platform of knowledge first, because AI sometimes will give you a lot of different diagnostic, let's say, tools, or maybe there's differentials, wide differential. You would be lost. You need to know what important things I need to focus in on based on your knowledge, based on your exposure. You need to build your own approach, and then after that you can testify, or you can just have an AI as an edited tool. It's not everything. It shouldn't be that you start with the AI and they cut you get your shortcut. No, you have your own knowledge, your own approach, and you need to verify something. That's okay, but you start building your knowledge based on the AI. I think for now, at least, I'm not sure about the future, but for now you will be using the AI with every single patient, and you'll lose your own clinical basis. Mm-hmm. Because you'll be an AI and then it's an artificial intelligence based resident. That's how I call it. If you don't have your cell phone, you don't know how to approach the patient. If you don't have quick access to the AI, you don't have what should I do now? I need to ask AI. And if you transform this as a habit, asking AI every time, your brain will stop thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Because it will find it too easy just to get the diagnosis and put the differential and that's it. I'm not a big fan of that, but I'm not sure about the future. Again, what will be changing? But I would say, make sure you build your own approach first, and then you can testify that with AI help assist.
Yeah.
That's really good advice. What I'm hearing is that there is no substitute for experience.
Absolutely not.
That is the number one thing in medicine, it seems. You have to get your reps, you have to see more patients and think for yourself.
Yeah.
For me, this is my first year clinical rotations. It's unbelievable. I'm noticing how much more I learn when I have a resident or an attending who gives me the opportunity to give it my shot on my own, to present the entire assessment, entire plan, and then they can let me know their thoughts. And I think those are the most memorable experiences. The reason I remembered that experience of trying to figure out which type of ulcer is this is because I was able to think out loud, and then you were able to fill in the gaps.
Yeah.
So I think that you're right. The experience is number one.
Yeah, experience and these moments of brainstorming. You need to get to the point that you have a moment of brainstorming. Do you know what's your capacity, or to test your knowledge? And I always, by the way, I always tell my students and residents, make sure with the clinical reasoning, make sure that common things are common, that everyone know, and then know the common things of, like common presentation of common things, and then rare presentation of common things, and then common presentation of rare things, and at the end, rare presentation of rare things.
Mm.
Don't mix it up, and then you feel like there's some rash here. Maybe it could be vasculitis, prevalence 1 in 1 million. Don't jump up to vasculitis before thinking about the common things. That's my general approach in clinical reasoning, always to follow common things.
Yeah, I think that's good advice, especially I think medical students get excited about the rare diagnoses.
Absolutely. I was one of them.
Yeah. Now, you've talked a lot about how experience is one of the most important things. I'm curious, in your experiences, do you have a memorable patient case that you'd like to share?
I remember a case in my time back in Qatar, and it's a very interesting case. I remember a gentleman, like around 20, 21, a young gentleman. He came in with a fever and he had a lymphadenopathy in the posterior part of his neck, and then to the emergency. He was a student in Qatar, but he wasn't local. He was from Far East Asia. At that time, as a clinical reasoning, they just starting building up my approach, as I was saying. And the first thing you can look at him, you will see this most likely EBV It's very common, young man, just fever, cough for 10 days in the college. This, all the things is going toward EDZ. And based on the anchoring that's here, you are anchoring in some information. And we did the antibodies with an ABV and came positive. And then the patient discharged the second day with just conservative management, some painkiller, and he went home. And then after a couple of weeks, he didn't improve. And then he came back to the emergency. And then I saw him again. We were in the same month of the medical, we were in a medical team. And then he had a worsening in his lymphadenopathy, fever, and they start having weight loss this time. And then with lymphadenopathy, and he had an EBV positive, and then they think maybe something else. Let's just take a sample from the lymphadenopathy at that time. And also, based on the background and where this patient came from, and then they considered tuberculosis and just because of the lymphadenopathy, weight loss, everything, and they were right. We did an aspiration from that guy, and PCR tuberculosis was positive. Can you imagine when you have a very high endemic disease in some area? It might come with everything. You might have, like, let's say, you might have abdominal pain because of gastroenteritis, and you tested positive for tuberculosis or something else. This is not the end of the story. PCR came positive, PCR sensitive for RIBE, patient discharged RIBE. 2 months of RIBE, patient is not improving. 2 months of RIBE, patient is not improving.
Wow.
And then I was following the patient, he is fine with mine, just my favorite patients, like the follow-up patient in the surgery. And then after 2 months, got admitted again. I wasn't the physician or the resident taking care of him at that time. And then for reason I don't understand, in the second admission, they didn't do a biopsy. They did only aspiration because they thought about tuberculosis. They fixed belief in this tuberculosis. They did aspiration, came positive. You confirm what you think. This is the definition of anchoring. And then they discharged it. They did excisional biopsy this time. Can you imagine or can you guess what happened? Or what the diagnosis was? He had lymphoma.
Wow.
This is one of the incredible cases that I encounter, most incredible cases I encounter in my life. Three diagnoses in one, that's unbelievable. And then the lymphoma, it was like Hodgkin lymphoma. Maybe there's some association between EPV and Hodgkin lymphoma, but at the same time, to get the tuberculosis on top, like three in one, that's mind-blowing. Now, the point is, and I take it from there, it's just, I learned the lesson of just try to avoid the anchoring bias in a hard way. Like when you think, always, when you think about a patient, put all the data in front of you and consider everything. And again, common things are common. But what I look back to that experience, why we consider EBV in the first place? Because we assume this is a young guy, he just had 10 days of EBV. And I don't think there's a problem with the first diagnosis because just the antibodies came positive. But then he went home and come back after 2 weeks with weight loss. I think we should have done that excisional biopsy from the first place, and we did that culture and everything, and maybe we figured out. It's a case report now. I think this is one of the most incredible cases. I learned a lot.
Wow. It's clear you still think about it all these years later.
It's 5-6 years now.
Wow. And do you know what ended up happening?
The patient received the treatment for lymphoma at that time. He did very well with the right treatment, lymphoma. I saw him in my clinic in 6 weeks, a 6 month or so. He's doing great, man. The entire thing, he learned a lesson and I learned a lesson. He is now, I think he had a major of engineering or something now. But yeah, I remember the story very well because myself, I start anchoring from the first spot. This is a college patient. He just 10 days, some lymphadenopathy here or there, some splenomegaly. This is EBV and then move otherwise. But yeah, it turned to be something more exciting.
Wow, what a fascinating case.
So I might also like to ask you, in your practice, do you have, you know, a unique or maybe unconventional habit, a technique, or some sort of tool that you think has improved your ability to take care of patients and also improved your diagnostic skill?
Yeah, Andrew, I consider myself as a good listener. So I feel like if you listen actively to your patient, I spend a lot of time when I have a new case. Like I spend an hour just asking questions and then listening to them, listening what they will say, they will tell you. And like evidence-based, they will tell you like 80% of the diagnosis you'll find in that HMB and physical exam, maybe more. I feel like the diagnostic tool, everything will come after. But if you listen actively to your patient, you'll figure out a lot of mysteries in the story. So this is first. And the second thing, I visit my patient multiple times a day. Unfortunately, with the new system nowadays, with the medical records and you need to write notes and, you know, put orders, you will see your patient once or maximum twice a day, in the morning and then just pre-rounding on him and during the round. And that's, by the way, is just building a huge gap between the physician and the patient.
In my unconventional trick here, or just tool, I visit my patient 3 or 4 or even 5 times a day.
Wow.
In Cook County, we have a geolocalization. Like last year, it was fascinating. Like you are in a role, like almost beside the whole department or the whole floor. You can just walk through and then just 2 steps and you can be around your patients. You will see your patient around the clock. You can figure out a lot of symptoms. You can figure out a lot of things. It absolutely, it will be hazy or murky for you if you just saw him once a day. You can see the progress and improvement. You can see hour by hour change. I mean, that's my, I got to be honest, my unconventional habit. And I kept doing it. And also before leaving home, I have just a quick check on them. Are they okay? Everything is okay at 4 p.m., 4:30 before they sign up. I feel like it worked very well. I don't have any surprises.
Wow. That's very good advice. And I will take that advice because I think that feeds into so many different areas. It helps not only you to know what's going on with them, but they trust you more. They yes. feel cared for more.
They know your name. They know a lot about their physician, and then they start like even they start telling you something they think it's not relevant, but it's relevant to their story.
Yeah.
Believe it or not, you might figure out a very rare diagnosis just based on chit-chatting with.
So thinking back to your journey thus far, I'm sure there have been moments that you might have considered a failure. And I like to ask my guests about a, quote, favorite failure you may have had in your medical journey. Something that maybe in the moment felt like a big setback or a big mess up, but ultimately shaped you into becoming a better clinician. Do you have any stories or any experiences that you would say is a moment that might be a favorite failure of yours?
I would answer this question in 2 levels. First level on my during my journey, and the second level is specific cases on my own personality. The journey, as I said, Andrew, the visa rejection to the States, I remember myself back in 2014 when I applied multiple times and then it got rejected. At that time, there is a spark in my brain telling me to start practicing the same medicine or start learning just your internal medicine residency at that time and just building the one who I am now. I think that failure with applying to the visa gave me an opportunity to build a different person or a different doctor or shape a different doctor with different skills. Because I'm just going back to that time. If I got accepted and came to the state, maybe my dream will be different. So get 3 years of non internal medicine, be an hospitalist and live your life. And most of my friends, they did. But I think this one of the rejection of failure, I wouldn't consider it as a failure more than just, as you said, detours in your life. Sometimes it will give you a positive impact in that later on. But in my personal experience, I would say overconfidence. Like when you start feeling that you are putting a lot of correct diagnosis and you're a junior resident and you feel like you can diagnose any kind of cases. Like I remember one case, like when I missed the diagnosis of lung cancer because I just assumed this is most likely necrotizing pneumonia and discharging the patient home. And I was pushing for discharge. He's okay, he's stable. And later on, it turned to be lung cancer because of the cavitar lesion I missed. I learned a huge lesson. Maybe a failure, absolutely, because we missed the diagnosis. But I mean, I learned that overconfidence sometimes is fatal. You need to be confident, absolutely, yeah, but not overconfidence. And then that's what I learned about medicine is a humbling experience. It's more than you need to know everything. No, it's more about doing the right things with the right patients, more than doing the right things every day. That's my take on that point, yeah.
Yeah, thanks for sharing. Yeah. And I think it seems that it speaks to how important the team you work with is, because you have to be willing to admit where maybe you don't know, I imagine, or maybe when you're not as confident about a diagnosis. So I imagine that the team you work with, your co-residents, the attendings you're working with, will make a big impact on how comfortable you feel in those situations.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
When it comes to clinical reasoning and advice we give to people early on, medical students, junior residents, you are in a position where you're very good at teaching, you're very good at mentorship. What advice would you give to people early on about honing in their clinical reasoning skills? And with this question, is there any advice that you see that's commonly given that you think actually should maybe be ignored? 2 questions. 1, what advice do you have for people who want to build clinical reasoning? And 2, is there advice you've heard that you think should be ignored?
All right. So I think I answered this question before about the clinical reasoning for the students. I would say to build a good approach, you need to have a great fund of knowledge. And that's what you're going to get from reading, studying, and studying. Second, when you do the clinical reasoning, I follow the Bayesian method that everyone, I think, follow here. based on statistics. And to learn the statistics, you need to read a lot, which is obvious. And then applying that to every single patient, tailor that everything for your patient. And now, as I mentioned, like always think about the common things that are common and don't jump to the very rare cases. As you said, it's not about figuring out 20 million diagnoses. It's about just doing the same thing every time in the same way. So you build up your approach. And then one thing I think you should ignore, I always heard about it, study smart, not study hard. I don't believe that. I think this is a statement here. I remember it back when I was preparing for my USMLE, that maybe it will be very good advice and in someone is sitting for the USMLE for such exams, but it's not in medicine. I would say you need to study very hard. There's nothing called, what the meaning of smart, studying smart? Just about, let's say, pneumonia, just to study the smart case of pneumonia? I'm not sure if this is the right terminology. And students, unfortunately, they keep repeating it and they think the shorter the amount of information about the diagnosis or about the disease, the better they will remember. I would say not. If you read 100 words about the disease, normally you will forget 60%. At least you will have 40 correct words about this diagnosis. But if you learned only for words about this diagnosis, you will remember maybe word, maybe not. Mm-hmm. That's my philosophy. There is nothing called study smart. You will need to study smartly hard.
Yeah, I think that's good advice. How do you keep up with such a fund of knowledge as a resident, especially so deep into your residency and you're so busy all the time?
Yeah.
What's your advice to residents in training to make sure they stay on top of things?
There's two things. One of them nowadays with the subscription to the journals, my favorite is the Journal Watch, the New England Journal of Medicine, I think Journal Watch and Plus. You're going to get every week the most updated research or data in the field that you are interested in. Let's say you are interested in cardiology, you can subscribe for that, and then you're going to get what the recent updates. But I say for medical students and also for residents, they need to know the baseline or at least the basics of medicines. You need to stick with one textbook, read it, digest it, as I always say, and then you can build on that with the journals and with the updates. But without the platform, you cannot just read the updates. You cannot read only journals and the guidelines, and you don't know the pathophysiology of the disease. So build up this, and then you can keep up with these tools.
I think that's great advice. Yeah. Naeem, you've had many experiences, different countries, different patients. I'm sure there's been moments where you felt stuck. I felt like I've thought this through so many times, I don't know what the next step is. How do you refocus? How do you find clarity when you're in these moments where you feel like I don't know what to do next? Or do you not have these experiences?
To be honest, all of us, like we feel like overwhelmed, especially when you have a long journey, a lot of up and downs. Most of the time, they just go off the steam. Like I play Muay Thai. I'm not sure if I told you about this. I feel like even in the gym or doing my favorite sport, this is something you can just de-stress yourself and just clear your mind. But more interesting and more important for me, I speak with someone who knows me very well. So I don't put a lot of energy to explain myself, and I get a lot of help. I have an overseas friend. Now we are almost 18 years. I would say, 18 years we've been friends. And then he's a physician back home country. And also my life partner, my wife. When I speak, I feel like I'm almost lost. I need just someone to remind me who is the real Naeem, what should I do in this situation if I'm clearly, my mind is clear. So that's helped me a lot. And especially different in different times and back in my journey. So yeah, I would get a good friend and then he knows you well, and then just your hobbies, just get off the scene.
Yeah. You recently became a father.
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
And I'd like to know, how has your experience of being a physician changed, if at all, since becoming a father?
That's an interesting question. I always say, like, when you are single, just set your dreams when you are single, because you can do whatever you want. And once you are married, like, there is some limitation. But when you have kids, everything is different. Now, in my situation, I was planning to apply every single cardiology program here in the States. Now I'm just restricted with some programs, but just I want to stay around my kid. Absolutely, there is some restriction in your career, and we have to admit that. But in general, you feel like you are not sacrificing. You are not sacrificing your dreams, or you need just to put in your mind the idea of balancing. Now, what you need to be present around your family, and at the same time, you need to follow and pursue your dream. I'm trying just to find the best balance between these two. I don't want to go too far or extreme in the right or extreme in the left and just losing my family just for my dream or losing my dream for my family, and I live with this regret. In the middle, just trying to neutralize and be present in both. That's my approach for the next couple of years.
Wow, that's excellent. It's heartwarming because I think to look at someone like you who's gone through over a decade of training at this point and still be able to consider your life outside of the training as part of the whole experience, that you have to factor that in, because ultimately I'm sure it's part of what makes you happy outside of the hospital as well.
Absolutely. I had this question multiple times. I was asked, how can you continue all these years? I always tell them that medicine for me is not a job, it's a hobby. When I feel passionate towards something, you can spend 18 hours a day just reading or discovering new things. When you deal with medicine like in this way, and you are enjoying learning the new information, enjoying seeing new cases, I feel like I'm not a nerd at the end of the day, but I love this feel. And then that's just fueled you. And then you feel like, oh, okay, I'm not doing something stressful. This is more passion and more than stress, to be honest.
Yeah. So you'll be starting your role as a chief resident pretty soon here. Do you have any goals for that year? Do you have any aspirations? What inspired you to become a chief resident? And what do you hope to achieve during that year?
The teaching experience. Basically, I'm not a good guy with setting up tables and schedules, and I'm not the best one. But education and teaching experience, I think this is the most appealing part of being a chief. I have two things in mind for now. To be honest, I felt during my time here in the States, there's something ignored in the medical field, which is a big side physical exam. I've been teaching students for 7 years, maybe. In general, the medical students, they are excellent here in history taking. They are super excellent in history taking. But I feel that when it comes to the physical exam, we struggle a lot. The reason why I know that's instead of just palpating the spleen, get the CT scan done, that's an old or outdated, but I feel like being a physician, that part of being a physician, just to see your patient, approach the patient, examining them, put your stethoscope, know the different types of sounds you are hearing. That's like also reward you. Not only like feel the patient will feel comfortable because you are examining them and you are putting time with them. At the same time, you feel rewarded as a physician. When you hear an S3 in your auscultation and you can tell I'm in front of a heart failure case without any overload symptom, you will feel more rewarded than look at the echo and the ejection fraction display. That's my take on that. That's the first thing for the bedside teaching. And the second thing I would say, I have a series of lectures for the new juniors next year. I hope they not get bored. Just so the most common approaches and most common diagnoses in internal medicine and how to build up your skills in clinical reasoning.
Yeah, oh, that's exciting. Well, in the future of medicine, so much can change. We don't know how much of a role AI will play. We don't know how much role politics will play, systems will play. But I'm curious to turn the page towards the excitement of the future. So to you, Naeem, what excites you the most about the future of medicine?
I would say the machine learning approach. Recently, we've done a workshop here in John Stoizer Hospital of Cook County. It's about data machine learning. And then Dr. Stutz is running, he's the program director of this. And I think this is now it's going jointly with Rush this year. I joined this workshop last year, spent about 10 weeks or more, I think. I learned a lot of new things about the machine learning and how you can use data and manipulate data just to get a very nice differential or to help you with putting some orders. My new project was about teaching residents and even the attendings in the outpatient clinic how to put the best or the appropriate stress test for a patient with chest pain. The guideline is always evolving and then changing. So you always feel like there's a low risk, intermediate risk, and high risk, and then an intermediate risk. See, maybe we can get the SPECT or PET or whatever. So we just, through the machine learning, we come up with a very nice algorithm. And then the people here in the hospital, they help us behind the screen. They help us just to program everything. And now you can put one plate, and then there's a screen in front of you, tell you and direct you. So you can make sure that's 100% you are getting the right stress test on your patient. You don't need to think a lot, and then it's too easy when when you use this advancement and you use these tools, it will make a huge difference in that patient care.
Wow, that's exciting.
Yeah.
And can you tell people who are listening a little bit about what you're learning in this master's program and how you hope to use it in your career?
The master program in clinical investigation, the interesting part, when I signed up to this master a couple of years or last year, my take or my, what can I say, and my way of thinking at that time, I want to learn structural research. So I want to know how to do research in an academic way. Everyone of us do research, do abstract and IS, a lot of retrospective analysis. But I wanted to learn it in an academic way and like dreaming about being a trialist in the future. That's what fueled me in the first place. And the program structured very well. It's a 3 to 4, 5 years, I think, program. You can get it in 2 years or 1 year. It's based on your time. It's required a lot of time. You need to put a lot of hours a week for them to sign it. But I seem like I'm totally different when I'm not like the one before this semester and after this semester. I learned, especially when the journal club stuff and understanding the bias and what behind the analysis and when they play with the data and the clinical trials and why it's look like the secondary outcome, the primary outcome, why this is important, why it's not important. It will help me as a clinician at the end of the day, especially based on the newest trials that come down.
Yep. That's incredible.
Yeah.
So thinking, I'm going to put you on the spot here. 10, maybe 15 years from now, what's the dream for you? What would you be doing that today, if you look to that point, you would feel proud of?
That's an interesting question. I always dream to be a good educator, teacher. And then I think if I get the chance to be a cardiologist, not, doesn't need to be a specialized cardiologist, a general cardiologist teaching cardiology slash getting, being a trialist in cardiology, that's my ultimate dream. Maybe they are... I don't want to lose the clinical part and be just only scientific part. No, I want to be in the middle. But I would hope that's my ultimate dream to be a good educator in cardiology.
Amazing. If there's one lesson that you want people listening to take away from your long journey and all of your expertise, what would it be?
I would say about the journey. There's a good quote I always remember. I think it summarizes my entire journey. It's said by Winston Churchill. It's about failure and success. He said, success is not final and failure is not fatal. But what matters is that to continue. So the courage is to continue. And I always think about it. Sometimes I have some success, it's temporal, it will just fade. You need to continue. And then always when I say you continue, and then you put in your mindset, you have to continue. And then you continue. I would say always don't look at the failure once or twice. That's the end of the story. It's not the end of the story. You still have time. Just have the courage to continue. That's what matters.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you'd like to talk about?
Not specifically, and not having anything in my mind, but just as I said, be persistent, believe in yourself, continue to do what you think it's the right thing, and don't listen to others when they think you are crazy. If you didn't do something crazy in your life, or if people, they think it's crazy, you're not doing anything. When I did my second residency, they told me I'm repeating again, and I said, yes, I'm repeating again and again until I get my dream. Other people, they look at my journey as just wasting of time. I think maybe if you have the good circumstances and you can get your visa easier, I would say yes. But always these, as I said, detours in your life, you will learn a lot from them once you pass it. Once it's done, you will just throw back in that time. You will, oh my goodness, I learned this from that experience. And there is nothing called failure.
Thanks again for listening. Person, time, and place. We'll see you next time.